This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 262, where today CJ and I are going to talk about his move to AKS. Recorded live July the 5th, 2018. Are you being asked repeatedly to integrate different business systems in ever narrower timeframes with increasing process complexity? What if you could standardize the way you build these business processes so your team are focused on higher value tasks versus the nuts and bolts of running the processes and integrations? Nintex can make that happen. With the Nintex platform, work flows from person to person, system to system, to the cloud and back. Got a custom system you want to connect with? No code extensions let you plug into systems simply and easily using REST and Swagger. With Nintex, work just flows, so your teams can work smarter, work faster, and be more connected than ever. Try it out for free for 30 days at www.nintex.com/trynwc. Hey, CJ.
How you doing?
I'm moving a little slow today. Today's the day after the 4th of July, Independence Holiday in the U.S., and I'm not moving slow because of too much I had to drink. We were actually all kind of, the people that I was with were all kind of joking and saying, God, the way we all feel, it's like we had a lot to drink yesterday, and we didn't.
I have to drive to work in the mornings. I'm, you know, unlike you that works from home. And this morning, it was glorious. It's like there was nobody on the roads. It was perfect.
And you love those.
I would like to say I hope every day is like this, but like I do feel a little bit shady, and I suspect the country's productivity would take a steep nosedive if everybody was partying as much as they were yesterday.
Yeah.
Every day. Yeah.
It generally, for those of you who are outside the United States, July the 4th is our Independence Day when we did the first original Brexit.
Yeah, gotcha.
There's a great picture where someone, like people post around from like the Queen saying, Happy Independence Day or Happy Treason Day, you inglorious, you know, ungrateful bastards.
And yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Someone has a great picture response to it. And it's George Washington. And it says, it's only treason if you lose.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I guess, well, unlike Brexit, people wanted to leave Britain, right?
In the United States, yes.
In the Independence Day version, yeah. I sort of get the feeling like that the UK is kind of regretting their vote, but anyway.
Yeah, we do it traditionally as a day of like, you know, barbecue, people go to the beaches, family, we shoot off fireworks at night, and the whole idea is about just showing like celebration and everything. So
yeah.
My immediate family and my cousins, usually it's just one set of cousins, but thankfully my extended cousins he's in the military and they move all around the country and they live in the Northeast. They live in New Jersey right now. They were in town. So we get to get together with them. Some friends of ours joined us. We all usually go out to the beaches. We've been dealing with a lot of storms lately. So we ended up just going back and forth to the pools and community pools, and then go down to St. Augustine, the oldest city in the United States. And we watched the fireworks down there, which
nice.
For my family, it was a little special this year because we missed it last year being with the family because it was just about a week removed from my son having knee surgery last year. And the year before, and when the last 2 years, we've gotten the city, St. Augustine, has gotten flooded, 6 to 10 feet of flooding from two different hurricanes.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that.
So where we were last night, we would have been back last September under about 10 feet of water. So it's kind of nice to be back there and see everything back to normal.
Yeah, nice to have a bit more of a normal year, I guess.
Yeah.
Excellent. We hung out with friends out at their lake house and some barbecuing and some laughing and some paddle boarding and stuff. It was really nice. Very relaxed.
So I got a question for you. What's the temperature like out there for you guys?
Today it is 82, I think we're going to get to. It's going to be the high, 82, yeah.
So we lucked out yesterday where it's like in the low 80s for us as well. 80 Fahrenheit, and we had a breeze.
Freedom units, given it's the 4th of July.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's like, we weren't even, you know, we're at the pool, we're outside by the water and everything. We were in Florida, we're not breaking a sweat. There was a breeze going. It was kind of overcast and sunny, then overcast and sunny. A couple of storms rolled through to keep things cool. So it was like, we were looking around like, this is ridiculous. I don't remember sitting out here watching fireworks and not like just sweating like a pig. So
that was a good day then, huh?
Oh, it was fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
Excellent. Yeah, I don't know how you deal with the heat. I suck at that. I've never lived at a super hot place.
Yeah.
And so I don't cope well with it at all.
You know, it's funny. It's to each their own, right? So I look at it and say, I don't know how you guys could deal with like the gloomy overcast and rainy for so much of the year, but
yeah,
that's what you're used to.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
Hey, we this is fun. I'm looking forward to this show. I know this is we've talked about this a little bit off and on about what you guys were about to go through and do. And you've done it. And so, I mean, we're gonna dive into the meat and potatoes of the show. Is I really want to talk to you and share the experience with our listeners of Hyperfish's move from, well, Hyperfish's move to Azure Kubernetes Service, or AKS. And we'll get into the details of what that is. We got a little bit of news that we want to run through first, but I'm really looking forward to talking about this with you today. I hope I'm going to learn something and hear what y'all's experience is like, and our listeners should be able to get something out of it as well. But first, why don't we dive into some of our news here?
Yeah, let's do that.
All right, CJ, there was the first one that you got a bit of news here that you wanted to talk about. I know we both have two different perspectives on this, but why don't you tackle this one first with some Cloak and Dagger APIs.
Security by obscurity, as it seems. Yeah, so there was an interesting report that came out on June 18th titled on a blog from CrowdStrike called Hiding in Plain Sight, Using the Office 365 Activities API to Investigate Business Email Compromises. So what's happened is, for a while, there have been some forensic firms or investigative, I don't even know what words I'm supposed to use here, what they call themselves. But there are these companies that come in and they do, forensics on when you're hacked and what have you to figure out what happened, right? Anyway, so it turns out there's been a few of these firms that have had access to an API in Office 365 as part of your tenancy that gives a lot more detail on who's viewing what and when and who viewed which emails and for how long and all these kinds of things, that it's been hard to get that data in particular cases if you don't have audit trails turned on and certain SKUs don't have access to different things, to the various audit logs and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, there was a rumor floating around for a period of time that some of these firms had access to the special data feed or they had the special forensics tool. And it all started with a Microsoftie that had left and went and joined one of these firms and took some code with them about how to access this hidden API. And so this hidden API it's kind of a bit janky. It's not in the graph. It's directly on the Outlook endpoints, right? So outlook.office365.com/API/v1.0/then-the-user-context/activities. And you have to pass, obviously, an authorization header, so you have to be authenticated to call the API, but you also have to pass this other hokey sort of header, exchange.behavior, and then you have to pass this parameter to it. Anyway, so it gives you access to this API that's kind of hidden. And so what I meant by security by obscurity was this is undocumented and not really like any of the other APIs to call, but it gives you access to a whole bunch of information that organizations find really interesting. So where these forensic companies are coming from is when you've been hacked and you want to know, sure, a hacker got access to the CEO's inbox, for example, say. That's interesting to know, right? And you can assume that like all of the data in that person's inbox has been compromised. But it would be super useful if you knew which data in that person's inbox had been looked at, right? So you could narrow it down a little bit. And that's effectively what this API gives you access to. So it gives you access to things like what individual emails were read, which ones were selected through OAuth, what searches were entered into the search box, all that sort of stuff. And so there's an argument to be made here that says this data is not that special. It's the company's data anyway. You have to be authenticated. It's not really a breach or a hack, which it's not, right? But the important part here is that this API was unpublished. It's super useful data for companies. And everybody's like, huh? Why on earth aren't they making this available to everybody? Mm-hmm. And what's sort of fascinating about it is these companies that had the knowledge of this used it in their marketing as like, we've got the special tool. These other companies don't. And so you should come and use our services, which I thought was pretty entertaining. But anyway, so now CrowdStrike have published a blog post detailing the API, exactly how to get access to it, retrieving activities from it, what sort of data comes back, how to deal with the data. They've even got a little GitHub repo with some script to help you get access to it and pull it all out. So in effect, if you're interested in all the sort of activities on a user's mailbox, then you can go take a look at it.
There's a few things that I definitely want to call out on this too, that this article or this blog post got a good amount of news of about a week or two ago on Hacker News. And the blog post was published on June the 18th, but I became aware of it from the from Hacker News and a bunch of people putting a bunch of comments on there. And initially when it came out, it seemed to be people were talking about it as like this thing that you could use for getting personal information or nefarious stuff or anything. And it's not at all like that. This API is called the Activities API or the Office 365 Activities API. The title of the blog post is pretty appropriate too. It says hiding in plain sight. And all it does, I mean, it doesn't give me access to see what is in your mailbox. It doesn't give or see what people have done with your mailbox. It is, I could use it to authenticate, to find out what I have been able to see with my identity. So someone, I could use it to say, hey, have I been compromised? I think I have been compromised. Let's go back and see what I potentially could have, I had access to or what I looked at from say this time to this time. And if I knew that I wasn't, you know, checking my mail or I wasn't looking my mail or anything, then I could say somebody clearly hacked my account in the span of this 24 hours. And here's the things that someone using my identity was able to look at that I can say, yes, I was compromised with. So it's not this is truly a forensics tool. I can see what did this individual have access to.
Yeah. So there's interesting activity types in here, like were emails deleted, forwarded, links clicked, marked as read, unread, delivered, message sent, moved, open an attachment. Here are the two I like. Reading pane display start, reading pane display end. So you can see when people were selected particular emails and viewed them. Reply, search result, and server login. Not sure what that one means, but just some interesting activity. And I think, you know, it's no big deal, right? Information wasn't hacked, but the fact that this information is available in the service, but they make it quite hard to get at, or some of it wasn't available in the past, I think everybody was like, huh, should really make this public and document it.
Well, and what's interesting too about it is that, I mean, like we said, you know, it's public, people, it was available. Some guy with knowledge of it left Microsoft, went to one of these forensics firms, took the knowledge that it existed and used it as a product offering or a service offering by them. And then some other companies did the same thing, or some other forensics companies did the same thing. What I found interesting in the article was that I can't remember exactly when. It was in the post somewhere. But what was kind of interesting to it was that when somebody went to like a security briefing or some event at Microsoft, and they pulled two different independent conversations, they pulled people aside and asked them to confirm or deny this. And two Microsoft employees both independently said, this is not possible. This does not exist. And then it did exist. So, I'm not labeling these two people as lying, but I mean, you know, they may be just ignorant of the fact that it actually existed. But that's where there was some weird kind of like smoke around it, which was like, you know, was it being hidden in plain sight? Was it people weren't aware of it? It seems more like, you know, you could look at it in the very non-nefarious way, just people just flat out didn't know that this existed. One guy did, and he used it to his advantage as going to go work for this other company. And so this company has just blogged about the fact that, hey, this thing exists and these
it's
tools
out there now.
Mm. Yeah, this Python script that people use to go through and to pull the information out, to pull in the CSVs and to where you can slice and dice it, they just took a copy of it and made it available for anybody in case the original source went away.
Yeah. I think there's a couple of interesting things that come out of this. One, I wonder if it hasn't been published because it sort of circumvents a bunch of privacy rules and stuff. And perhaps it's being used for, internally at Microsoft, it was being used for forensic analysis when it was required, but they didn't make the data available to companies to get access to necessarily because it might skirt around some of the other rules and policies that Office 365 puts in place. So that's possibly one reason why they haven't made it available. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see if they turn it off.
It will be. And you're right. You make a good point. You know, what about if it's certain things that maybe it's certain things, two sides. One, it's maybe they're tracking certain things like reading pane enabled, reading pane disabled, or, you know, stop being enabled. Maybe that stuff that goes against privacy rules, like we say GDPR, or maybe on the other side, it's we don't want people to know these things that we're tracking these things. Like, you and I have talked about it offline. I'm playing with Facebook ads a little bit. And I was talking to some people last night. There were, you know, my cousin owns a small business. And he's like, what kind of things can you see? I'm like, well, you run a video ad, and I one of the metrics is, did you watch a video for more than 3 seconds? He's like, it's a minute long video. Why do you care if they watch it more than 3 seconds? Like, because if you're scrolling through it in the newsfeed and the video starts playing and you look at it for a half second and then keep scrolling, that doesn't really count.
It's not really a view.
Yeah. If you view it more than 3 seconds, that is a view. I mean, great. If you watch more than 25 seconds or 30 seconds, that's different. But I can tell that you're at least paying attention to what it is before you dismiss it.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's like, they track that? I'm like, yeah, they track that. It's plain sight, but just because you don't know about it, it's not as obvious. So,
CS, hidden APIs, it also makes you wonder how many more of these things are out there.
Yeah, it is.
What else have they got that they've got hidden in plain sight with APIs?
Have to start hammering away at the endpoint, get your auth token and start passing away, trying to hit other things like, does it respond?
Brute force dictionary attack API paths? Ooh, yeah. That sounds painful.
Let's stop doing some 401s and or 404s and let's see if all of a sudden it's like, nope, 403. Like, hey, there's something there.
Something... Yeah, yeah, nice. Okay, cool. So yeah, that's some hidden APIs.
I've got a couple little firehose things, little quick little Azure nuggets I can throw out here. So one of them, VSTS, had a cool update that shipped towards the end of June. It's a big UI update.
Yeah, I noticed this.
I've turned into being quite a fan of VSTS for a lot of my stuff. All my private repos, I've been moving over to from GitHub over to VSTS. And this new UI update and the old update was really clunky to me. The new one just feels much cleaner, much less confusing. Of course, you know, who moved my cheese is going on a bit with mine. So I'm trying to figure out where things are. But I mean, it's a UI update. It's in preview and you can turn it on. So I got a link to it where you can go see the update here on the other day they've shipped.
Yeah, I noticed this come through. It's kind of a, I don't know, I never really understood the previous VSTS UI. I always used to keep clicking around until I found what I wanted.
Yep.
It was more sort of, you know, discovery by brute force clicking than anything else. So I'm kind of glad to see some UI updates in this space.
I do. I agree with that too. I love how they actually publish their updates too, where you've got this one page you can go to and see a list of, you know, by dates on here's this update and here's this update. So I love how they do that.
Yeah, that's nice.
Another one here is... the Azure team at the day before, earlier this week, actually on July the 3rd, they published a new Cosmos DB Explorer that is now in public preview. And effectively, it gives you the ability to take the ability where you can look use the Azure portal to view data inside and like a query analyzer inside of your that you have in a Cosmos DB. This is now a full screen, you know, standalone web app that you can use for the Data Explorer to explore your data. So instead of being locked into working just inside of a blade and the Azure portal, now you get the whole thing.
Yeah, Cosmos DB is really cool. Like, yeah, we need to talk more about that again at some stage. It's an awesome service.
We do. I would like to bring somebody on to talk a little bit about, like, you know, modeling a NoSQL based or document based database. You know, a lot of people I think are, you know, coming from the same mindset that you and I come from, which is we're traditionally on the relational database side, and I see the value in querying and writing to a document DB, and I love Cosmos DB, all the features it offers, automatic indexing. I love it. But when I sit down and try and take something that I'm working on and I say, well, how do I make this into, how do I port this idea into a document DB? And, you know, am I creating one gigantic document for a customer and all of his records? Or how, you know, I used to think relationships and where do I break up into different documents? And that's the, you find, so if anybody's a listener and you got a lot of experience with that, we'd love to talk to you about that. Come on the show and learn some more about it.
I'm yawning here. I'm like in this nice warm room, and we're talking, and your serene voice, and it's like, and the 4th of July is still hanging over my head. So excuse if I go and pause periodically and yawn, but it's not because you're boring. It's because I'm lagging.
No worries. You're about to be the one that's going to be on deck in just a second. So I can get through these next two bits of news here, and then I'm going to start interrogating the hell out of you.
Oh, I better wake up.
Well, I can get out of your groggy stupor while I do these last two.
Sounds good.
Another bit from the Azure blog. This is a pretty big announcement. Announcing the general availability of Azure SQL Data Sync. And this is, think about a service that sat in the middle of a crossroads where you've got data in Azure SQL databases, you've got data in SQL on-prem databases, you've got data in SQL, say, inside of Azure Stack / databases. How do you keep all this data in sync? How do you shift this stuff around? We ran into this problem years ago with what was it called? That thing inside of web content management inside a SharePoint server where we had to, or inside a SharePoint server, we were trying to ship the data around content deployment. And we were using different like packages and moving data around. This data sync is a hard thing to deal with. And this allows you to synchronize data between multiple types of SQL Server-ish endpoints. I say ish because, you know, SQL Server on-prem, SQL Azure SQL Server, both unidirectionally, that's not too hard, and bidirectionally.
Huh. That's a lot harder.
Yeah. That's a lot harder. Who wins on conflicts? How do you deal with conflict resolutions?
Oh, yeah.
Really cool. And with the added bit to it, data sync service meets GDPR compliance as well. So talk about getting even more complicated with the sync.
Interesting. I'm going to have to read up about how they do that because multi-master replication is one of those kind of age-old problems that nobody seems to get right.
Okay, so I got one last bit of news here. Do you want to do this one? Since it kind of goes into yours, or I can throw it in and we'll start working on it.
You kick things off in this space.
Yeah, all right.
And then we can go further with it.
Before we dive into the meat and potatoes of our episode here, another bit of news that was announced in the middle of June was that not only has Azure Kubernetes Service, AKS, not only did it GA in the middle of June, but they also have new regions, more features, and increased productivity. Now, we can go into a lot of depth on all the different things that they've added here. They've got new regions available to it. They've got plugins for Visual Studio, Visual Studio Code, integrations to extend into DevOps with using AKS with CI and CD tools like Jenkins or VSTS, a virtual kubelet, which is really cool as well. There's so much stuff they've got on here with this. But this blog post, and they have a blog post here up on the Azure blog from the middle of June by Brendan Burns, who owns this. But instead of going through and talking about all the stuff around, you know, GA and everything with it, let's talk about like real world stuff.
Doing it. Yeah.
But before we do that, let's take a quick break to hear from one of our podcast sponsors.
Raygun provides full stack error, crash, and performance monitoring for tech teams. Whether you're a software engineer looking to diagnose and resolve issues with greater speed and accuracy, a product manager drowning in bug reports, or you're just concerned you're losing customers to poor quality online experiences, Raygun can provide you with answers. Get full stack error and performance monitoring in one place. The next time you're struggling to replicate errors and performance issues in your code base, think Raygun. Head over to raygun.com, get up and running within minutes, and dramatically improve your online experiences for your users.
All right, Mr. Johnson, you guys have gone through quite a change recently, and you've been going gaga offline in different places on your love for not only Kubernetes, but for Azure Kubernetes Service. So we've got a link to your blog post that kind of explains, you know, what you guys did. But in a nutshell, what did you do?
Yeah.
What did you do?
You know, often what's fascinating about this is often on this show, right, we talk about services that come out in Azure, and then both you and I go, yeah, we should really try that out and do it, right, and give it a shot and play around with it. And it's usually not for quite a while that we get a chance to do that because we're all busy and we've got other stuff to do. This time, however, AKS came out, Azure Kubernetes Service, at precisely the right time and alignment for what I was requiring in my day job, right? And so the sort of the moons and the stars aligned on this one, and I was able to do something about it. And so just to give a little bit of background to listeners that wonder what I'm banging on about here is we run the Hyperfish service, obviously, and it's a container-based SaaS application that runs in the cloud for the most part. There's some pieces that run on-prem, but for the most part, the bulk of the service runs in the cloud in Azure. It was already a Dockerized and containerized service, but we used a product called Docker Cloud, which I think I've mentioned on the show a few times historically, for doing sort of orchestration and management of our SaaS-based cloud application. So what do I mean by that? That means we used that application for doing things like scheduling containers on particular nodes in our cluster, running particular containers, keeping an eye on them, making sure that they were up and running and that there were five of them or two of them or whatever it happened to be, right? And deploying our application. So we'd use it to say, hey, we want to put out these updates. Here are the version changes, and go and work on rolling out those new versions of the containers out into our cluster and get them up and running. And so we use that across some development environments, some test environments, and our production environment. Anywho, a few months ago, we got notice that Docker Cloud were deprecating their service, which honestly was not that much of a surprise because Docker have been focusing on their enterprise products like Docker Enterprise Edition, which are paid products that you deploy. And they'd sort of signaled their focus on making money, at least reading between the lines to me. And so everybody that was, I was part of a customer advisory group for Docker Cloud, and the customers that I was speaking, the other customers that I was speaking to there were like, this is no surprise, this is going to go away at some point, doesn't seem like a priority for Docker anymore. And so we were all starting to think about what our alternatives were. And of course, at that time, Kubernetes was also picking up a ton of momentum over the last couple of years, but also more importantly in the last few months, it's becoming kind of the go-to, right? And so we all started looking at Kubernetes, and I was thinking, man, I really don't want to run a Kubernetes cluster myself. Like, we're a small team. I don't want a whole ops team just dedicated to running a Kubernetes cluster. And then along came, very fortuitous timing, along came AKS, Azure Kubernetes Service, right? And we're an Azure customer. We really want to stay in Azure, and we're kind of committed to that. But it was out in preview, and I wasn't particularly fond of the idea of running a production system using preview bits from Azure. I don't think I'm that crazy. So we were worried that AKS wasn't going to make it in time to GA for us to be able to move. And we actually got an extension from Docker Cloud. They handled things pretty poorly. They gave everybody 2 months' notice that Docker Cloud was going away. 2 months, right? And I don't know about you, but in my books, that's like going around to your friend's place, emptying their fridge of beer, and then just leaving without talking to them, right?
That would have gone well yesterday.
It's a bit of an FU and a bit of a slap in the face, at least in my books. Like, I think that is a really poor way to handle. If you ever want to keep customers, that's the wrong way to go about it.
Yeah.
That said, they were very gracious, I guess, I can't think of a better word right now, in giving us an additional 2 month extension. So 4 months to complete deprecation, which we're about a month away from right now. So just under a month away from. But they were only doing that on a case by case basis for customers that really needed it. Fortunately, in this time, AKS GA'd. And as you know, we've talked about it on the show, covered some news about AKS. And so AKS is now generally available as of a few weeks ago, or a month or so ago, something like that.
Yeah.
And we were able to move to it. Now, we had a backup plan. We were going to run a Kubernetes cluster in Azure ourselves if we had to. But we're really glad that AKS came along and saved our bacon.
This is, like you said, the timing worked out well. We talked a little bit about what AKS is. In a previous episode, actually back from Build, and when you interviewed the AKS guys in episode 251.
Yes.
Earlier this year, like just a month or two ago. So I wanted to talk a little bit about about your experience and kind of going,
yeah, sure,
migrating over to it. So you had an existing containerized infrastructure. We can't go into the whole details of that. What does that mean going into a containerized application?
Sure.
So let's assume, we've talked about that in the past on the show. So let's assume that our listeners, understand what that is or what's involved in doing that. But I know that, Kubernetes does have a bit of a, it's kind of different, but it's not different. But they have their own way of kind of doing stuff where, mm-hmm, you've got your application inside of a container, but then that container kind of goes into another construct. So can you talk a little bit like what that was like in terms of taking your application, having to understand what is that new construct of working with pods, and how hard did you guys find in mapping what you currently had? What was the effort like in going from,
yeah,
I'm a Dockerized infrastructure, I need to be a Kubernetes Dockerized infrastructure?
Well, so the first thing listeners should understand is that Kubernetes is just a different way of running Docker containers. So you don't have to rebuild your code. You don't have to do anything, or at least we didn't have to. We didn't need to change any of our code or any of our containers. We had to make a couple of little tweaks, but I'll explain those in a second. But we really didn't have to fundamentally change any of our code or the way our application runs to run in Kubernetes, right? Kubernetes is really about the management and running of your containers, not the way you build your containers or the way you code your code, right? It's not like saying I'm moving from .NET to Java, right? Or Java to .NET more likely, right? So it's not really about how you write your application. It's how you run your application that Kubernetes really helps you with. So from that perspective, it was quite straightforward for us, right? We had a set of Docker containers that we run, and that forms our service. And there's about 20 of them in total that make up our, give or take 20, that make up our service. So there's containers, things like front-end web application, API, right? We've got another one we call the change processor. We've got another one we call the audit processor. We've got another one we call the broadcast processor. There's all these little services that make up our bigger service. And so we had those as containers already. They run Node.js applications inside them, written with TypeScript and all that. But we basically lift and shifted the way we run those containers with Docker Cloud to the way we run those containers with Kubernetes. And so what was involved with doing that is, if you're familiar with Docker Compose, Docker Cloud was very similar. Basically, Docker Compose gives you a file that defines your application, right? It says, here are my containers, here are how many of them I need, here are the configuration for each of those containers, and links between them and how you talk between them, right? And then when you say Docker Compose up, Docker Compose will create instances of all of those containers for you and get them running, right? Kubernetes is kind of similar. There's different words for the same kinds of concepts, like pods, for example. But fundamentally, you're just running the same containers. And so, but what we had to do is take our definition of our application from Docker Cloud, which they called a stack file, which was analogous to a Docker Compose file, and move them to Kubernetes configuration files, which do the same kind of thing.
So it's kind of like going from like looking at your Docker Cloud or your Docker Cloud stack files or your Compose files. That's kind of like your entire system map or your application map of how the entire Hyperfish process runs. And you had to map those over to Kubernetes configuration files, which was effectively, here are our different pods.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, Kubernetes has concepts of things they call deployments, services, replica sets, pods, and containers. But in a nutshell, if you just, like, pods are the most important, they're the things that are running your code. Like, there's containers that run in a pod. Pods are a grouping of containers that run at the same time and that are related tightly, that can't run without each other. So you have a series of pods that you put containers in that run your application, yeah. And then everything above that, so replica sets, are just about making sure you've got multiple versions of those pods running at the same time if you want more than one running. And deployments are really the top-level construct about a piece of your application and how it gets deployed and run. So there's different words for the same kinds of concepts. And it's really, the job was really about translating what we did with Docker Cloud and the definition of how we achieved that in Docker Cloud and how we translated it to Kubernetes configuration files. And that's that was the bulk of the work, actually, that took most of the time. The changes that we had to make to our code were very minimal and were specifically, we used a naming system for the way we read environment variables in to configure a container. So when a container boots, it gets its configuration from environment variables. And our naming convention that we were using in Docker Cloud for environment variables wasn't compatible with Kubernetes. Oh, okay. And so we had to change the naming convention for how we defined environment variables. But the rest of our code didn't change at all.
So just like name value pairs, you were just trying, just renaming the name part of the keys.
Exactly, yep. We were using a character in our naming convention that wasn't valid in Kubernetes, and we had to change it to a different delimiter, basically.
Oh, yep. That's not that bad.
No, so it was pretty straightforward. So yeah, we built the first version of those Kubernetes configuration files. Actually, we built them off our Docker Compose file that we used for our development environments and translated those to Kubernetes configuration files. And that meant that we could stand up a Kubernetes cluster in Azure, deploy those configuration files to it, which would instantiate all of our containers and get them spinning up and running, and then we could go in and look at them and see if they were booting correctly and working properly. And that, in a nutshell, that was a kind of our migration. There's some additional stuff around the edges, like sort of services to help manage it and keep an eye on things. But outside of that, that was the bulk of the work.
That's cool. I mean, there's a couple things that I was looking at in your blog post that I thought, you go into the depth, you know, explaining what Helm is, how Helm comes into play which with Kubernetes. I don't know if we want to go into that much depth in this as well. But there was something in here that in your post that I thought is what really, you did a good job of explaining the value of like a containerized infrastructure for an application in terms of how quickly you're able to spin this thing back up. or to create a new instance of it. If you've got a new developer that's coming online and you want to be able to test your application and show it to someone, like if you wanted to, you were pitching a huge customer on using it, and they're like, well, let's see how this whole thing works. Instead of having to go through and to like onboard them, you're like, well, let's just spin one up for you really quick and you can kind of see and you can play with it a little bit. You got in here like, you know, it says, hey, that's a lot of words. What's the payoff here?
Yeah.
You have two commands that you would run with the Azure CLI.
Yep.
Get the entire Hyperfish service up and running. Is it really just two commands? If you, assuming you have an Azure subscription, is it just two commands and ta-da, I've got my instance running again?
Yep. It's that simple. So the first command is az aks create and then some command line parameters. And that's to get your entire, that is literally the extent of creating a Kubernetes cluster in Azure, is one command on the CLI. And you pass it things like, what resource group do you want to give it? What do you want to name the cluster? What do you want the admin name to be on the nodes? DNS prefix name, node count. There's some other ones that you can add, like OS volume size, SKU name for the virtual machines for your worker nodes in the cluster. There's additional config params, but they will go into that one command. And so that can take 5, 10, 15 minutes to complete, depending on how big a cluster you're deploying and how fast Azure happens to be and what region you're deploying into and all that sort of stuff. But it's literally one command. You've got a fully functional Kubernetes cluster running in Azure. Zero additional work.
That's crazy.
Then the next command is deploying your app. And this would be a lot more work if we weren't using a tool called Helm. So Helm is kind of like, if everybody listening is familiar with ARM templates, right? They're a way of defining your infrastructure in Azure, and then you can go create that infrastructure using your ARM template, right? In a very simplistic form. Helm templates are the equivalent of that, except for your application definition in Kubernetes. So you can define your whole application in what's called a Helm chart, which is kind of like the ARM template. And then you say, apply my Helm chart and create an instance of this application in that Kubernetes cluster using that template. And you provide all the parameters to that as part of it. So here are all the values that you want to feed into that template to create your application. And so if you were just using Kubernetes configuration files, right, you might have hundreds of those. And rather than going and creating them all in your Kubernetes cluster or scripting the install of all of those, Helm gives you a way to package those up into one package and say, here's the definition of my application. Now go deploy it in Kubernetes.
Mm.
And so the second command, after you've created your cluster, the second command for us is a Helm installation. And that deploys our application to the Kubernetes cluster. And it takes a number of config files, right? One is the Helm template. And then the second and third are what they call values files, which are kind of the values of those parameters that you want to pass the template. And so those could contain environment-specific configuration. So things like
connection strings.
What's the connection string? What's the DNS name that you want this website to be under? How many API containers do you want? Stuff like that. And those can change for each different environment. Anyway, you supply those as part of these values files. And so our second command, Helm upgrade or install, deploys that app, deploys your application into the Kubernetes cluster. And so it's literally those two commands. If you want it publicly accessible, you got to point some DNS at it and stuff. Those are kind of outside of those commands, like pointing your DNS at the right place to give it a vanity URL and all that. That's separate.
And that's it. I mean, you guys went this big cutover this past Saturday, I think it was.
Yeah, last Saturday.
Yeah. So I mean, it took what you say it takes 10 minutes to spin it all up. So moving a few IP addresses around. So what you did a service window that lasted what, like 10-15 minutes?
Unfortunately not.
Wait a minute, Kubernetes didn't work the way I thought it would?
Kubernetes worked fine.
AKS didn't work as well?
AKS worked perfectly fine. Unfortunately, parts of Azure didn't.
Oh, no.
Other parts of Azure didn't.
A 99.9% SLA means you're protected from power outages, bad patches, natural disasters, and maybe even a dinosaur attack. Does it protect you from yourself, though? AvePoint Backup for SharePoint Online provides full fidelity backup and recovery, from individual items to entire team sites. AvePoint can run backups up to 4 times a day to ensure your data is secure. Recover anytime you want, without having to pick up the phone and schedule restore windows. Learn why AvePoint is the Microsoft Cloud expert at www.avpoint.com.
We scheduled a four-hour window on Saturday. with our customers saying, we have the potential to be down for 4 hours, knowing full well in the back of our minds, this will probably only be 20 to 30 minutes. We had our full production application up and running well before the window opened. So the week before, in fact, it was all just sitting there ready to be cut over. However, a number of our customers whitelist our IP addresses, right? They put them on the allow list and their firewalls and things like that. And so we have static IP addresses as part of our production service that customers rely on not changing. And we needed to move those around in our infrastructure as part of our cutover so that those IP addresses were on the new infrastructure and everything was hunky-dory. That's the bit that broke.
Oh, no.
So we went to go move those IP addresses, and you can do that, right? It's so long as they're basic IPs and static and they're in the same region, you can move IP addresses around in Azure. We were moving them within the same subscription. We were moving them from one resource group to another resource group as part of the transition. And that broke, and it got into this weird state where it looked like the move had completed. You could see the IP address in the destination resource group, but Azure left the destination resource group locked. And by locked, I mean not the locks that you can add and remove through the portal. I mean like Azure thought it was still moving stuff around, and we couldn't touch our production our new production infrastructure while it was locked. So it was, we couldn't add stuff, we couldn't remove stuff, we couldn't move stuff, we couldn't change configuration of load balances, we couldn't do anything, either through the portal or the CLI. It was fully locked. And it stayed that way for 4 hours.
Oh, God.
And we logged a Cerve support ticket with Microsoft, which is supposed to have a 1 hour SLA. 3 hours later, we still hadn't heard from Microsoft, but we'd already started scrambling with alternative plans. And fortunately, this is where the beauty of those two commands come in, because we were able to spin up a second mirror of production, completely mirror what was currently locked in our locked resource group in a separate location, spin up an entirely new version of production with AKS, deploy our application to it, get everything up and running, make sure it was all tested. And then we had to do some hacky stuff with getting traffic to it so that we were within our maintenance window and we were back up and running for customers when we said we were going to be. But we were able to do all of that by the end of our window, no problem. So, and we were up within, I think, 5 minutes before our window ended, which was kind of nerve-wracking. But of course, you know, Murphy's Law predicts that as soon as you go do all of this work, that things fix themselves, right? And sure enough, as soon as we'd got the second version of production up and running and traffic was routing to it and we were all back up and running and everything was hunky-dory, the original resource group became unlocked again. And we tore it all down. Yeah. And we were like, no, resource group, you are dead to us. You failed us. We are not going to use you again. And all of your infrastructure that was in there, we grabbed those static IP addresses that we needed and moved them back out of that resource group into the final destination of where they should go. And that second move worked fine. Like that second move worked fine. And then we tore all that infrastructure down and got rid of it.
Did you ever find out what the problem was? I mean, we're sitting here on Thursday. That was on Saturday. Did you find out, like, did Microsoft ever get back to you on, here's the outcome of why stuff failed? And
no why so far. So the case is still open. And so far I have, from Microsoft, I have, yes, it looks like something went wrong. I want to say, no shit, Sherlock. I could have told you that. No, I'm only kidding.
Yeah, but that's frustrating. I mean, you guys pay for a service contract, a support contract with Microsoft. You know,
I get that technical things go wrong, and that's bad, but, you know, shit happens, right?
Yeah.
Pardon my French. But what's really disappointing, you know, this is like having an argument with or a discussion with your child, right? It's not that you started a fire in your sister's bedroom.
Yeah.
It's that you didn't own up to it afterwards, right? And that's really the issue here is like, I get it. You have a technical problem. We got past that. It was painful, but we figured it out. But it was the lack of response on the support ticket and the lack of urgency on it. And like when you use a cloud provider, you're at the whim of them, right? And that's just comes with the territory, right? You don't have a reboot button in your server room you can go hit necessarily. Right. And so you rely on them to help you when things go sideways and wrong and when their service doesn't work. And when you can't rely on them, it makes me really nervous.
It's, you know, I remember back in the day when we did stuff, we didn't have this cloud provider. I worked for a Fortune 300. We had services that we would have that we used, or products we used on-prem. And we had a couple outages. And I remember that the rule was, is that if, you know, you were on a call, you had a 7A call, if it got to, I think, 2 hours in, then they're checking in, they're starting to escalate it. And if you got 3 hours in, I mean, I remember there was an operator that would come on the call and they'd start scrambling people to start buying tickets and putting people in planes and coming to you at the 3 hour mark. And if you hit 4 hours, then it's like, all right, those scrambling, those plans went into effect and people were then on the way. They didn't get it closed out within 4 hours. But with a service, I mean, it's kind of like, you guys are hosting it. I mean, fly to yourself, you know,
yeah.
Figure out what the hell's going on here. But that, it's interesting because on one side of you says, I'm paying for the service. I pay for it to work. When it breaks, it should be like all hands on deck to get this fixed. I shouldn't have to pay for support to get it on, to get it fixed. But if I am paying for support,
you really expect it.
I demand it. I mean, I'm paying for this. And I get that, you know, they have financially backed SLAs, but simply coming back and saying, oh, we'll pay you for that 4 hours your service wasn't available. It's like, that's going to be a couple hundred bucks max, right?
I don't care about that at all. I just want you to answer the phone.
Yeah.
Or the ticket, right? In our case. But, you know, yeah. So I guess the lesson learned from this is obviously don't expect it all to go smoothly, which, you know, and we didn't. We had fallback plans. We had rollback plans. We were able to mitigate them without having to go back to our setup on Docker Cloud. But we have, you know, we had that as a secondary rollback, right? So, yeah, you're just at the whim of things working right. Fortunately, in this case, it wasn't AKS that was broken. It was something more fundamental than what went on with this IP address move in Azure. But it was just disappointing, you know, and kind of painful.
Yeah, that's frustrating.
But all in all, like the move went surprisingly well. Other than that, we didn't hit any other issues. We're back up within our window. We thought it was going to be a much shorter day than it was, but things have gone well since then. So yeah, AKS is working well so far.
Our listeners might have noticed that we didn't publish an episode last week because you and I were both kind of taxed during the week, and we had planned, hey, let's try and go through. We may try and get a recording in over the weekend. And I know when I didn't hear from you by a certain point on Saturday, I knew you were going into this on Saturday, and it's like, let me know how it went. And then I know about like 4 or 5 hours into it or something like that, and I got a colorful text from you. I was like, yeah, I don't think we're recording today. I'm not even going to bring this up.
Yeah. I guess the final thing I'll say on this is these are all, like, you know, lots of words some people may not understand.
Yeah.
If you're interested in learning about how to build apps with containers, the best short tutorial, if you're a Microsoft developer, is there's a link on the blog post right at the bottom I'll link to, which is a short tutorial on ASP.NET plus Docker. And it walks you through, like, just getting a basic web application running in a Docker container, really simply. And then Kubernetes in Azure, they actually have a similar short tutorial on creating an AKS cluster in your Azure subscription and deploying a really basic web application to it and getting it up and running. And it's super straightforward, I think, if you're interested in starting to learn about this.
Very cool. Very cool. Good stuff, man.
And then finally, listen to Gabe Monroy's interview from Build that we did if you want more info on the background of the service.
Yeah, that's in episode 251. We've got other episodes too that we interviewed, like Kelsey Hightower and Brendan Burns on Kubernetes. They're not currently published. We have an issue with our site where we're having to unpublish old episodes, about 100. We're only able to keep about 90 or 100 episodes published at a time because of something with our feed. CJ and I are working to migrate the site to another solution that'll get rid of that. Maybe the feed won't have it, but you'll at least get all the back episodes from our site.
Yeah.
Let's just say it's a royal pain to get that fixed now. It's easier to migrate to a new platform, but easier is in quotes.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
We're getting there, but we got a couple of the links here too related to Kubernetes. The one that I posted up here, it was a really good interview by the Chick-fil-A tech blog, where they talk about how they use Kubernetes on bare metal on three little Intel NUC devices at each one of their stores, and how they run it locally, how they boot it up, and they explain their whole process behind it. So I found that to be,
wow,
it's a really interesting way to do it. But it's, you can see how something like Kubernetes and containers makes that deployment from their central ops so much easier.
Oh yeah.
Having to remote manage and all that stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I've heard, actually, interestingly, in a similar kind of thing, I've heard Toyota, I think it is, are starting to put Kubernetes in their entertainment systems of their cars so that they can do like remote updates and management of your in-car entertainment systems using Kubernetes. Something, I think it was Toyota, somebody like that.
Very cool.
Kind of crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, we did have, we have another post too that's interesting where it does, there's, so Azure is one, has one hosted Kubernetes offering in AKS.
Yep.
They weren't the first ones. Google was the first where they had their Azure container service, which is...
Not Azure. Google
sorry.
Container Engine.
Yeah, Google Container Engine is their hosted container offering. And then AWS, we talked about that a couple weeks on the show, where Amazon had their own offering that they raced. But they got theirs out as well. They went GA like a week or so before Microsoft did.
Yeah, marketing stunt.
There's a really... Yeah, potentially. There's a really good blog post, though, that you grabbed and you put in the show notes as well that goes through, like, it details the differences between each one of them and stuff. So,
yeah, just sort of feature-wise, what the, you know, what each of the cloud providers offers from their managed Kubernetes service. Yeah.
Cool. What do you say we do some picks?
Let's do it.
AC's Voitanos delivers on-demand video-based training for developers on the latest SharePoint extensibility model from Microsoft in his course, Mastering the SharePoint Framework.
CJ's Hyperfish automates the collection of user profile information from users in organizational directories such as Office 365, SharePoint, Active Directory, and HR systems. The secure service supports on-premises, hybrid, and online environments. Bring your directory to life at hyperfish.com.
All right, CJ, I've got two picks today. How many do you have today for us?
I just have one.
Okay.
You should start since you have two.
All right, I'll knock mine out real quick and then I'll let you go. I'm going with the non-developer-ish kind of stuff.
Okay. So
the first one I did is a book that I just finished reading, or I guess technically I listened to, and it's called Conspiracy, Peter Thiel, Hulk Hogan, Gawker, and the Anatomy of Intrigue. So this book came out earlier this year, I think it was. I listened to the audio version of it. This is fascinating. So this is something that really, this is a story that really kind of finished in the last year or two. And in a nutshell, I'm not giving anything away because it's a true story. In a nutshell, Gawker is a site. It's still out there today, but they don't publish anymore. So you just see all their old stuff. And it effectively is like a tabloid that would, an online tabloid that their mission was to make things public at the great expense. And this wasn't part of their mission. This is my editorialing. At the great expense to whoever they were going for. So if it was, you know, like a TMZ showing an artist that's getting out of a car without their underwear, without wearing any underwear, but they flash themselves.
Yeah.
They show that kind of stuff. They out people who are gay, who are not in the public eye or in the public eye, but they're trying to keep things secret. Just anything they can to get eyeballs. And one of the things they did is they outed Peter Thiel, which apparently like the worst kept secret or the best kept secret, something like that. That was like plain sight. He never kept anything secret about being gay, but they were like, they alluded to the whole thing. Like, here's why Peter Thiel wanted to stay in the closet because of these business reasons. It's kind of like someone saying, "Hey, CJ, when did you stop beating your wife?" Like, you can't say, "I don't beat my wife anymore," but I never did. So
yeah.
Anyway, so the story is about Peter Thiel in a very interesting approach, creating a law firm, and over the course of many, many years, finding different cases around the country that they could use to attack Gawker and effectively bring Gawker down. And he did that with the Hulk Hogan sex tape. I'm a legal junkie, and it was absolutely fascinating to see how they did it. The word conspiracy has a negative connotation to it. And frankly, the end of the book, I was really irritated with because the author tried to basically blame the fact that Donald Trump is the president because of Peter Thiel, which was the biggest, his politics came through like horribly. And whatever you think about Donald Trump, it's ridiculous that you can blame it on one person. But anyway.
Interesting. That sounds like a good book. Yeah, I saw that all play out in the news, obviously. And if he really did go to all that extent to go do this, like a coordinated attack over the years because of that, like, A, what a pathetic individual. And B, what a psycho.
Who, Peter Thiel?
Yeah.
No, I don't. I disagree with that. It wasn't a psycho. He was patient, and he saw it as more of doing a public service where he's like, this site, there's no value they add to the society, and they hide behind a huge like $1 million insurance policy for legal claims that come against them. And so anything that is liable things or attacks that are genuinely where they've done stuff that is wrong and people have gone to sue them for libel, effectively, they just outlast whoever's suing them for their legal fees and they drain them. And Peter Thiel effectively went to Hulk Hogan and said, okay, you know what? Finally, you actually have a valid case here to go against them for libel. Don't worry about the money side. I'll bankroll it. And Gawker didn't know that there was somebody that was doing that. And they basically said, you didn't play fairly. It's like, so you're gaming the system, and because somebody is actually using the same game that you're using.
So he had to be in his bonnet with them about them outing him, but then he made it basically his mission to take them down because he thought they were just like morally reprehensible, basically.
Yes. Gotcha. I don't think he did anything illegal or anything. The author definitely takes the attitude of what you just shared. I thought the author did. I thought it was bleeding through, but I thought it was like, you know what? Good on you, man. He played by the rules just like they were playing by the rules. And it's like, because they got the short end of the stick.
I didn't get all that backstory. You know, my pathetic comment was more like, if you did all of this just because they said that you were gay, outed you, like, that's kind of ridiculous in my view.
It was that plus a lot more. I was trying to...
Gotcha.
Yeah, they continuously went after him, so...
Fair enough.
My other quick pick, and I'll let you go, and I won't take as much time on this one, was a podcast I just listened to. It's not a podcast like us where it's just constantly ongoing, but it's called The Habitat. It's by Gimlet Media. They do a lot of really, really good shows. There's, I think, about 13 or 14 episodes here. This one takes the Expedition 4 that went into the habitat that was... which is an experiment by NASA, putting, I think it's 6 or 7 individuals in a dome on a mountain in Hawaii to see what's it like with these people living with each other for 1 year and not being allowed to have any kind of outside exposure. What's the psychological impact on them and how do they interact and where's the things that come up when we want to go to Mars? We're going to have people living closer together and let's see what happens. I thought it was absolutely fantastic show.
I'm definitely going to listen to this. This looks awesome.
It's good. Good 30-minute episodes blazed through it. We just did it on a road show, so it was really good.
Nice. I'll have to listen to that. Awesome. Okay, I got one here. You know, years ago, Jay Allard, there used to be a dude that worked at Microsoft. He was responsible for a bunch of things, including the whole manifesto that kicked Gates over the edge on like doing something about the internet with Microsoft and Windows and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, he also had this other concept called the Courier tablet, which was a dual screen note-taking device. And it never went anywhere, but it was due to come out, or it was kind of on track to come out before the iPad, which in hindsight, you'd be like, man, if Microsoft had done something around that was iPad-esque, but before the iPad, like what could have that meant for the company? And would they kind of miss the mobile boat quite the same way and all that sort of stuff? Anyway, it's now been rumored that Microsoft are back on this bandwagon and that they're going to come out with a dual screen Surface mobile device, not as in a mobile phone per se, but a mobile computing device that's sort of foldable and has screens on both sides of the fold, like a little notebook, right?
Mm-hmm.
And The Verge has got some photos of renderings of this thing that are apparently pretty accurate and that they're still working on this. They've been working on it for a couple of years, that it might be sometime later this year that it comes out. Or early next year, not sure. But yeah, kind of interesting that they're back on this bandwagon. They canceled the Surface Mini device, right? So there was going to be a Surface Mini that came out, much like the iPad Mini, but it got canceled really, really late in the project. Apparently there was a warehouse full of these things, and because it wasn't going to be disruptive or compelling enough, right? And now they've got this dual screen thing that's coming out, and basically, the bet is, will this be enough? Will this be compelling or disruptive enough of a device that are interesting for people to get on board? And it doesn't look like they're tackling the mobile phone side of things, but more like the note-taking. Like, what's a notebook equivalent you can pop in your pocket, take with you to conferences or meetings or what have you? And so there's this new Surface mobile device that's, in theory, coming out soon. But we will see. I really like the idea. I think it looks really interesting. It's I go to conferences with my iPad Mini, but it's too big to put in my pocket. But I don't want a laptop or a full-sized iPad carrying around. I don't want to carry a bag. I just want a thing I can put in my pocket that's better than my phone for taking notes. I want to be able to write on it with ink and just have a bit more of an experience than my phone. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So this for me looks really interesting, for me at least.
I'm of the style that I do like to take my iPad, my full-size iPad around to conference. and take notes that way. What I guess for me, it's a cool device, and I'm curious to see what they end up doing with it. For me, like the ultimate note-taking thing is, let me take my existing iPhone, let me get an iPhone Plus instead of just a regular iPhone, and let it work with the iPencil to be able to take notes. And then I don't have yet another device to walk around with.
Well, that's possible. That'd be pretty awesome. Like, I could do a Plus with a pencil, maybe. I mean, it's on the small side for note-taking for me, but maybe I'd try it. Yeah.
That's where I'm curious to see where this size is. Where does the size of this thing fit? Because you can't really tell based on the pictures that we have out right now, but it's where does the size fit between the size of an iPhone Plus and a Mini?
It sort of looks like an iPhone Plus size, but twice as big. Does that make sense? Like, it looks like the size of an iPhone Plus when it's folded, and then you unfold it and twice the size. At least that's what the renderings look like to me. Maybe a little bigger than the Plus. Yeah.
I can't tell.
We'll see.
Curious.
Hey, at least I commend them for giving it a shot, because they're obviously out of the mobile game currently, and it's worth experimenting in the space. So we'll see if it goes anywhere.
Cool.
Nice.
That's a lot of stuff we just went through today. So what do you... I got a long show here. So, anything else you want to share with our listeners before we wrap?
Nope. We're good.
Let's wrap.
Cheers.
All right, man. Good to see you.
Did you like this episode? Please tweet about it and drop a 5-star review in iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show, and we'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a WAV or an MP3, and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is brought to you by Keith Ritchie. For more information on Keith's music, head to music.kritchie.com. You can subscribe to us in iTunes and the Google Play Store by searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show, or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook, searching for Microsoft Cloud Show, or on Twitter, at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up to our mailing list by heading over to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.